Tracy Borgs, who hosts this show. They give relationship advice that you ought to know. Your thirst for entertainment, they will quench, cause Stephanie's a darling and Mike is a mensch. Pork therapy, advice this good is a rarity. It's cool, fun, and introspective. Relationship talk from a liberty perspective. Oh, and did I mention you can leave a message, you can voice a question, a joke, a comment, or something more at 419-PT-LOVE-4. Pork therapy, scatty-dee-bop, shabadooey.
Okay, you're ready to blab.
I'm ready to blab. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Stephanie. Welcome to another episode of Pork Therapy.
Yes, another exciting, riveting, enthralling, wonderful episode of Pork Therapy. And notice that none of those adjectives were the dreaded S word.
And the fact that you didn't say special makes this episode extra special.
It's not often that I don't say special. Is very ironic.
And now we've just ruined it because we said special like three times.
Oh, blast. Anyway, well, this is truly a unique occasion on Pork Therapy because we have a guest with us.
Hey, you know what? You could have said it's a very unique occasion, then I'd harangue you for putting a modifier in front of unique. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, because unique is unique on its own. And,
I was pushing for that joke because you didn't even say it. So we do have a guest.
Yes. Anyway, right. Get back to the subject. And we have a guest. It's a guest that I very much admire, and I have enjoyed listening to his podcasts and knowing him in person for quite a while now.
Thank you. My name's Mike. Oh, no, it's not me.
We wasn't talking about you. But Mike, you know, I admire you very much. I'm very glad that you're my co-host on the show.
And I hope you listen to my podcast because it's also yours.
I think I've heard it once or twice or 96 times. Anyway,
so
our guest tonight is... as I was saying, someone that is very cool. He's got a lot of wonderful projects going on. Very active person in the liberty movement. And his name is Wes Bertrand. Wes, would you like to say hello and tell us a little bit about yourself and your projects?
Howdy, folks. Yes, very active in the liberty movement, but have not gotten thrown in jail yet. So I'm working on that. I actually moved to New Hampshire in 2006, and I lived there for about a year. And then I moved back to San Diego, which is where I lived for quite a while. I got my master's degree in psychology down there. Mm-hmm. And I was going back to San Diego to get involved in a clinical trial to treat my type 1 diabetes. Because I figured, you know, if I'm going to be a hardcore activist, I got to get thrown in jail, right? But, you know, 7 to 8 finger sticks a day for blood glucose readings and then the injections, it's just not going to happen in prison, I don't think. I'm not sure they take care of you there, like I do here on my own, you know?
Well, a diet of straight bologna is probably not too good for diabetes control, so...
I was going to say that 7 or 8 finger sticks a day is probably worse than jail.
Yeah.
It could be. Depends on what kind of finger sticks they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you run the Complete Liberty podcast, right?
Yes, I've been doing that for, over 2 years now, I guess.
I would like you to talk about that, but I want to say that I think, if my memory serves correctly, you started that as an audio reading of your book, Complete Liberty. Is that correct?
Yeah, I chopped it up into 10 podcasts, basically, and it ends up being about a little over 8 hours worth of content. So I did that initially in 2007 when I released the PDF for free on my website. You can download the PDF and the audiobook, obviously, for free. And then about a year or so later, I decided I really need to get the podcast going because I was intending to do that. So finally I did that, and I got some friends to do it with me on occasion in San Diego. I've got quite a few voluntarious friends down there. So
nice.
That was awesome.
That was really cool, you know, to get co-hosts on the show and to just explore the ins and outs of statism and freedom, basically.
Yeah, and Wes, I did want to interrupt you and just put in a book for your plug. A plug for your book, because I was there to witness the inception of Complete Liberty, I guess you could say, because Wes and I knew each other way back in the day when you were first working on the book. And I definitely enjoyed I enjoyed reading it, and I enjoyed like the creative process when you're making it, and the podcast came out great, the reading, the audiobook reading. And then the rest of the podcast content has been hundreds of episodes of awesome, so you should all definitely check it out.
Definitely. I don't recall,
yeah, I think
actually.
We're up to 125 now, so yeah, not quite as much as, say, Stéphane Molyneux, who's, you know, 10 times that, at least, more than that, actually, he's over 1,700
times.
Now.
Yeah,
I,
so,
I don't remember
incredible.
Actually if I read your book Complete Liberty or listened to it, but I did ingest it.
You poured it into
your
brain.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there that most people are familiar with because, you know, I'm drawing on a wide range of works from the Austrian School of Economics to Ayn Rand's Objectivism to Nathaniel Brandon's Self-Esteem Psychology, things like that. Some of the novel things that you won't typically find would be the chapter on intellectual property, which is going against that, and that seems to be a good trend now that's happening. Like at Mises.org, all the people there, like Jeffrey Tucker is the editor, and he's championing that, and Stephen Kinsella. So like, there's this realization that when you duplicate something, you're not stealing it, right? Because the other person still has what they have.
Yeah.
And the idea of owning patterns of information, just kind of being a...
Owning knowledge.
Yeah.
Owning what goes on in my head.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, of course, getting rid of the corporate structure and just having a completely voluntary society that doesn't have the typical things that you find under today's capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Which is more like corporatism or crony capitalism.
Or even fascism.
Yeah, because it's
definitely. And that really is at odds with what, you know, the big O uppercase objectivists contend about how we should have things based on the constitutional republic and a monopolistic government that's voluntarily funded. That was always a big sticking point for me because it doesn't make logical sense, obviously.
What happens if I don't want to fund it? I'm curious.
Yeah. Well, I guess you have to go without those precious services.
Great. That sounds good.
So you do have a choice. You can pay, get the services, or not pay and go without.
Well, that sounds not like a government. That sounds like an actual service.
Not really, because that little fictitious government would prohibit competition from creating.
Yes.
So you couldn't choose another protective agency.
So it's
you could
like
just
a monopoly.
Choose not to use theirs.
I see.
So it's like halfway there.
Yeah. See what you're saying, Mike.
Okay.
So Wes, you mentioned that you have a background in psychology, and that's very intriguing to us because, as you know, we do the show Pork Therapy because we're interested in sort of exploring the personal freedom side of things and thinking about how we can apply these concepts of voluntary interactions and getting along with people in a free society to our own personal lives. And tonight's podcast, we're going to be discussing something that I believe, and I think you believe, has really profound implications for liberty activism and just for human relationships in general. And that, of course, is nonviolent communication. So, Wes, do you want to give us a little... introduction? I feel like you would be a good person to start off because you were the one who originally brought nonviolent communication to my attention. So
yeah, I've been shouting from the rooftops ever since I came across this in detail. And
shouting.
It's funny because
sounds
I have
violent.
A friend in San Diego who actually went on a 10-day retreat, private retreat with Rosenberg. The Marshall Rosenberg is the founder of nonviolent communication.
Mm-hmm.
He calls it a language of life.
Mm-hmm.
And this was about 6 years ago that Trevor did that, and he spent 10 days and with about 40 different people. So he was really enthused about it at the time, and then when he got to San Diego, he joined the Nonviolent Communication Meetup group down there, which from what I have seen is one of the biggest ones around in the nation. For some reason, there's 120 people in that group, which isn't a big meetup group. I mean, like the Ron Paul meetup groups get over 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
I think San Diego had one of the third biggest one in the nation. It was over 1,000 people at one time.
Mm-hmm.
But like there's web development groups and stuff in New York City that are way into the thousands of people. But I really couldn't find much in New York City when I searched there, as well as in Boston. So for some reason, this has been in the shadows, this nonviolent communication. And throughout my academic experience, I've never encountered his perspective, and I just encountered it through talking with Trevor. He mentioned it. I went on the meetup group website and I looked it over, and you know, I took the red pill a long time ago, looking at things from a pretty radical perspective, and I just didn't see the philosophical background with this method, and it didn't really get into all the details. And I think what it amounts to is seeing is believing. So I ended up going on YouTube after my friend Kevin mentioned it to me again, and he said it's basically like RTR on steroids. And I don't know if you guys have discussed Real-Time Relationships, which is the book by Stephen Molyneux.
We haven't discussed it on the podcast, but I've read it, so I'm familiar with it.
Yeah. Oh, you guys had a conversation about it on Free Talk Live, the Free Talk Live episode, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So he has a perspective where you basically convey your feelings about the experiences that you had with the person that you're close to, family member, for instance. And then you try to see if that person is empathetic or curious about what you're saying. Well, my friend Kevin said that it's basically RTR on steroids. And I was like, well, what part of it's on steroids, right? And he said, well, have you read the book? And I said, well, no, I guess I read the first chapter, but I didn't delve into it. So then I was like, okay, I got to go do this. So I did, and I went on YouTube, and I looked at some clips. And I tell you, seeing is believing, because essentially Marshall Rosenberg has been doing this for a few decades, I think upwards of 30 years. He has a PhD in psychology, so he was doing the typical clinical psychology stuff, and then he shaped his method and learned this language, this sort of communication empathetic technique, just by practice, I guess. And he relates it in the audiobook. He talks about his experiences in Detroit when he was growing up there, and they had some race riots, and people actually killed each other. I think there were over 30 murders in that experience, and he was wondering, how in the heck do people get to this situation where they're actually killing each other, you know?
He says, what gets into us?
That was in the back of his mind, and he ended up... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I just remember him introducing it in his audiobook, and he said, oh, well, what gets into people that they do these things, that they get so violent with each other? And he said that question was on his mind for the rest of his life, and that was kind of what motivated him to go into clinical psychology. But then after a while, he developed this kind of new perspective on things. And I'm sorry, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, it's a new type of language that we're all actually familiar with, because it's basically speaking from the heart. It's being connected with your feelings and needs. And as a little child, you're really about self-interest and pleasure and discovering things, and it's all really true self stuff, right? But we live in this domination sort of culture, which has domination submission sort of memes in it, where we have to show deference to quote authority, and of course government is that par excellence, right? That we have to obey these laws regardless of how unjust they are and regardless of how dangerous they are to our life and well-being and the prosperity of society. So it's just this rewards and punishments and operant conditioning methods. And by the way, he actually has read Alfie Kohn's books. One of his seminal books is Punished by Rewards. And that basically looks at the sort of Skinnerian methods that people are using, the pop psychology that people use in our culture to get people to do things.
Right.
You know?
Carrot and a
using
stick.
Rewards and punishments, carrots and sticks. And this is predominant in parenting, in education, and in the workplace, as well as, of course, government.
Yes, I absolutely agree.
So basically, when I looked at this technique on YouTube and I started listening to what he's saying, I was amazed at the range of which this communication technique can work, like from personal relationships, dealing with disputes between lovers, to warring factions. I mean, he was working with a tribe, I think it was in Nigeria, that had been killing each other for years, right? And it took some of his trainers like 6 months to get them all in the same tent to try to mediate this dispute, right? And after a couple hours working with them, one of the tribesmen said, the chiefs said, Marshall, if we would have known how to communicate like this, we would have never had to kill each other.
Yeah.
You know? And that's a theme that's been stated over and over again in his experiences, that if I had known this communication method, things would have been dramatically different. I wouldn't have had to take it to the extremes that it went. I wouldn't have had all of these enemy images of the other person. And so what the essence of the technique is, or the language, is basically empathetic connection with the other person's feelings and needs, mm-hmm. while being aware of your own feelings and needs, and not getting caught up in the accusations and the judgments and the criticisms and the diagnoses and all those things that create resistance and defensiveness in the other person and then counterattack, right?
Right, exactly. And he's often said, you know, the key to two parties resolving a conflict is when they can articulate the other person's needs, right?
Yes. There was one instance, he has a workshop actually on YouTube, if you guys want to put it in the show notes. It's really instructive. It's about 3 to 4 hours long. Mm-hmm. It's chopped up into 10-minute segments because YouTube has that limit, right?
But, right. Yeah, that's worth going through. I think we should also plug that. I mean, I learned a lot from watching that, too. And, mm-hmm. you know, the audiobook or the book, Nonviolent Communication, is also just very, very helpful.
I've often felt,
you know, as you were saying, Wes, you know, one of these themes was, well, if I had known this earlier, then things would have been so different. And I was, the more I learn about this technique, nonviolent communication, it's like, the more I wish I had known this earlier and been able to apply it to some situations in my life in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is really an amazing method by which to get our own needs met, actually, because it's not a win-lose scenario. It's a win-win scenario. And the greatest difficulty, it seems, initially when you start looking at this is to figure out how to dissolve the enemy images of the other person in your mind so that you can build that bridge of empathy, because really no resolution can happen until that's done. And as he said in that workshop, he relates a story of, like, he asked the people, okay, who has the most long-standing dispute? And it turns out there was a couple there that had been arguing this thing for 39 years, right? And so they come up there on the stage and they say, Marshall, you'll never get this resolved. Like, we've been trying for 39 years.
39, wow.
Yeah, and he said, well, I can pretty much guarantee you that within 20 minutes of each of you being able to reflect back what the other person's needs are, what mm-hmm. they're feeling and needing, we can get this resolved.
Yeah.
And that's what happened, basically.
Because it's just
when
amazing.
You're connected empathetically with the other person, when they are feeling understood, in other words, then the wall breaks down. Then they're willing to extend the same empathy and return the gift of giving to you, try to fulfill your needs, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically the process. I mean, there's four stages. There's observing what's going on, connecting with the feelings, trying to describe the feelings in really specific detail. It's kind of a guessing process, you know, because you don't live inside the other person, but you can see what they're feeling. Mm-hmm. Pretty much. And if you don't know, you can guess.
Yeah, and usually the guesses turn out to be... I would say usually the guesses turn out to be pretty accurate because humans are empathetic creatures. But even if the guess is not accurate, then I think often the other person sees that you're at least making an attempt to get in touch yes. with their feelings and needs. And that, you know, helps them open up a little bit more. Is that right?
And who doesn't want to have their feelings and needs cared about, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a fundamental need. You know, Rosenberg lists all these needs that he thinks are kind of universal human needs from a psychological perspective. And one of them is, like, the need for visibility and to be understood and respected. Those are all needs that are, I think he lists as universal to human beings.
Yes, there's broader categories that he has, like connection needs,
mm-hmm.
and there's a whole bunch of those, like acceptance, affection, cooperation, consideration,
mm-hmm.
mutuality, love, respect, safety, security, all those sorts of things, warmth and trust,
mm-hmm.
and there's physical well-being, of course, mm-hmm. and he has sexual expression under that category, which is interesting. I would think that would be in the connection, but mm-hmm. I guess you can't experience that selflessly, right? You have to experience that within your physical being. So that's an aspect. Safety, shelter, honesty needs, authenticity, integrity, presence. The play need is a huge one for him because he sees work as play as well. Like if you're not doing something out of your own heart, like you're really dedicated and motivated, intrinsically motivated to do something, you probably should reassess mm-hmm. what you're doing because you really need to see it as a playful process, right?
Mm-hmm.
and then the peace needs, and of course for liberty lovers, this is a huge category, the autonomy needs.
Mm.
And by the way, everyone has these same needs. It's just the fact that some people are meeting their needs at the expense of other needs, and some people are trying to meet their needs with strategies that aren't doing it as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
That are really costly strategies, in other words. So our need for autonomy is huge. Choice, freedom, independence, space, and spontaneity. And then the meaning needs, you know, awareness. That starts to dovetail into Nathaniel Brandon's self-esteem principles of, like, living consciously.
Mm-hmm.
And being aware and self-expression, which is aligned with self-assertiveness and understanding and all those things. So this is all part of the process. And I've got some dogs barking.
Oh, how cute.
We noticed that.
They have some needs to greet people at the door, I guess.
It's their need for play, too.
And connection with someone's anus.
Oh, my goodness.
They're dogs.
They do like to sniff. So, anyway, so Wes, we actually have a little article here. I'm sure it's, you know, distilling this down to its very pop essence, but
yes.
I think we might like to read this article. It's called How to Practice Nonviolent Communication, and it just gives, and it's from wikihow.com, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep, that's kind of the study guide or sort of practical guide to doing it, right?
Yeah.
It's very short and very easy to understand.
Yeah, have you read this one before, Wes? Are you familiar with it?
I think I've looked it over, yeah.
Okay. So, Mike, do you want to alternate it off reading with me, or?
Sure.
Okay. Okay, so it says, this is a, like, how to practice nonviolent communication. Again, from wikihow.com. We'll put it in the show notes. So, number one, state the observations that are leading you to feel the need to say something. These should be purely factual factual observations with no component of judgment or evaluation. For example, it's 2 a.m. and I hear your stereo playing, states an observed fact. Well, it's way too late to be making such an awful racket, makes an evaluation.
Actually, it makes a couple evaluations.
Yeah, it's late and it's a racket, mm. Right? And then it goes on. I just looked in the refrigerator and saw that there's no food, and I'm thinking that you didn't go grocery shopping, states an observed fact, with an inference explicitly stated. Well, you wasted the whole day, makes an evaluation. People often disagree about evaluations because they value things differently, but directly observable facts provide a common ground for communication. So,
I'd like to think so.
Yeah, I'd like to think so too, but yeah, as it says, it's sometimes very difficult to phrase things as just a simple observation that makes absolutely no judgment whatsoever, right?
Well, I guess that could be the case. I'm thinking of a situation in my life relatively recently where there was a video involved, including evidence of something, and mm-hmm. someone refuted what they saw in the video. I mean,
so I was presenting
a tone or condescending or in some other way putting them on the defensive, but there are obviously situations where
two people
objective
the
facts
exact same video.
aren't always enough.
Yeah.
So maybe I even ruined the fact that there were objective observable facts by whatever attitude I was giving. I don't know.
So yeah, people that are resistant to seeing the facts before their very eyes typically are not connected with their feelings and needs, right? They're in defensive mode.
Yeah.
I mean, they're speaking the language of jackal, as Rosenberg says. He works with these puppets, which is a really good way to concretize this process, because the one puppet that basically false self that is not connected with feelings and needs, but is rather I think it's from a self-esteem point of view, it's when we feel threatened, our self-esteem feels threatened in some way, that we're not worthy, that we're not fit for existence in some way, feeling insecure, feeling defensive, those kinds of things. And we're taking everything personally, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So we're engaging in the shame and the blame and the guilt and the anger,
which
are all these sort of jackal processes, these false self processes where we're not connected to feelings and needs. So that's the one puppet. And the other puppet is the giraffe, which he picked because the giraffe is the land animal with the biggest heart, right? And who could get mad at a giraffe, right?
They just eat leaves all day.
Yeah, both pretty casual, and they seem to have their wits about them.
Yeah.
So it's basically a process by which the giraffe is curious and connects with that other person's feelings and needs in a way that they feel understood, and then the resistance can be lowered and dissolved, and then the person can actually see what their needs are that aren't being met.
Right.
So okay. This article on WikiHow says that the four steps to nonviolent communication are observations, which Stephanie just read, feelings, mm-hmm. which you just talked about, which I'll read in a second, and then needs, and then requests.
Mm-hmm.
So step two would be feelings right after stating observable facts. Step two, state the feeling that the observation is triggering in you, or guess what the other person is feeling and ask. Naming the emotion without moral judgment enables you to connect in a spirit of mutual respect and cooperation. Perform this step with the aim of accurately identifying the feeling that you or the other person are experiencing in that moment, not with the aim of shaming them for their feeling or otherwise trying to prevent them from feeling as they do. For example, there's half an hour to go before the show starts, and I see that you're pacing, which is an observation. Are you nervous? Or, I see your dog running around without a leash and barking, observation, and I'm scared. Feelings are sometimes hard to put into words.
Hmm.
So, the first thing that comes to my mind is that last sentence, yes.
Feelings are hard to put into
words.
Yes,
sometimes feelings are very hard to put into words, and that goes in two ways. One, it's hard to find the correct words, and two, it's hard to find the courage to do it.
Mm.
Yeah, saying that you're scared because the dog is barking is different than saying you're pissed off at that dog.
Right, yeah.
It puts you in a kind of a vulnerable position, exactly. Right, because you don't want to look weak or taught by the domination culture not
right.
to look weak or to admit to feeling
right.
these way, right,
yeah,
scared.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, remember that story that Marshall told about when he was doing mediation with a group of business people?
Mm-hmm, and that guy started to cry.
Yeah, one of the persons had said something that was really touching to him, and he started to cry, and tears were coming down his face.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the guy that organized this looked at him in a way that kind of was sort of harsh judgment. It seemed like he perceived that, and there was a flicker of his jackal self that activated. But then he gathered his resources, and he asked the man, are you feeling upset because your need to have someone who has their emotions under control in this environment was not met? And the man looked at him and he said, no, I wasn't thinking that at all. I wasn't feeling that at all. I was thinking about my wife who tells me that I can't show emotions and I'm like a stone. And
oh,
you know, they were in the process of getting a divorce.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So you can see how we can misperceive what other people are are perceiving it and even judging us. And NVC is not about judgment, moral judgment against other people. And this is a really fascinating thing for me because I've always been aligned with ethical philosophy and moral philosophy, and I have great sympathies for Molyneux's approach. But when I've explored NVC, I do see a huge difference between these two. And I think I'm going to be reframing my views on morality. Using the words moral and immoral can actually create resistance in people. You know, how many arguments have people gotten into online and on Facebook and so forth, and using the sword of morality, right?
Yeah,
or the
I'm more moral than you.
As a way to almost shame people into accepting the truth, right?
Especially in this movement.
Yes, yes. So I think that NVC has huge implications for liberty activism. But,
yes.
You know, getting back to how we are perceiving other people, this whole process of judging each other should be really based on value judgments, which are based on what we're needing, what we're feeling and what we're needing,
mm-hmm.
and oriented towards that rather than what that other person is doing that we don't like that's bad, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there's these interpretations, which are not actually feelings, that we really use a lot in our language, and it's hard to divest oneself of them when we've learned this language, all these different dialects of jackal, as Rosenberg says.
Yeah.
Things like, I feel abandoned, I feel attacked, I feel abused, I feel bullied and cheated and coerced and manipulated. You know, I feel intimidated, I feel misunderstood. That's a common one that people use,
mm-hmm.
which is not really a feeling, actually. It's bound up in an evaluation. That other person is not understanding us.
Right.
You know?
If you say, I feel misunderstood, you're really saying you're misunderstanding me, and that's making a judgment
yes.
on someone else.
Yes. So it's really difficult when we never really grew up with a good grasp of emotional vocabulary. Like, we didn't have this vocabulary of feelings that we were introduced to and discussed and you know, used in this nonviolent communication language so that we become adept at this and recognize the difference between evaluations and the feelings, right?
Right. And it's so interesting that you bring that up, Wes, because, you know, the emotional vocabulary, because we did a podcast a little while ago with Brett from School Sucks podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And a large part of our discussion was spent talking about how in government school and in the family structure, too, kids are taught that it's not okay to express their feelings. You have to keep the feelings inside, and it's not appropriate to talk about your feelings and needs and give feedback to adults. It's just, you know, you're being disrespectful if you give any kind of feedback like that, you know.
Well, being disrespectful, is that an accusation or what?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when kids...
When you say, I feel disrespected, that's not a feeling either, right? That's an interpretation.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, imagine what would happen if kids actually connected with feelings and needs and expressed them openly with NVC. Well, the whole domination culture would have to change, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be a very different world, for sure.
But you were mentioning, you said just a second ago that I feel disrespected isn't a feeling, it's an interpretation. But
yes.
That, and while that's accurate, I think a large percentage of the population in this culture anyway, and maybe it's because of government indoctrination centers, i.e. schools, but a large percent of the population aren't able to make that distinction, and so then there's a language barrier there. I am telling you how I feel. I feel disrespected, and they actually believe that's a feeling. And that could be a
and as he works that workshop, he has that jackal puppet on, and it's almost laughable when the language like that comes out, because you can see clearly that it's not connected with feelings and needs. Because he says all these sort of interpretations and diagnoses and criticism and defensiveness, all these kinds of things are basically tragic ways to almost suicidal ways to express please and thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the thank you aspect ties into the whole rewards thing. Just like Alfie Kohn, he recognizes that rewards are also a form of punishment, because when you say good job, or you're a good person, or you're smart, things like that, it's actually putting that person in the position of judge, you see.
Right.
So that's also not connected to feelings and needs with this language. And he has this process he shows to connect with what you actually are meaning to say. You know, what's the process of feelings and the needs that are being met beneath the thank you, basically.
Right. So, like, instead of saying, you know, thank you for talking to me, maybe you would say, I experienced so much joy when we talked, or something like that instead.
Because it met my need for, you know,
for connection,
really understanding communication,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
I use good job sometimes too, but I don't intend it to be bad, come across negatively or condescendingly, but apparently it might. So it just occurred to me that maybe a way to say that is, course it's contextual, but maybe another way to say that is, I'm proud that you overcame your obstacles, or I'm proud that you did so well, or something like that.
Uh-huh. And you did so well. That's from your perspective, obviously. So
okay, so that's still a bad job. Yeah.
I feel joy because this fulfilled my need for seeing someone doing this particular thing, right? The example that Marshall gives in one of the workshop, he relates the story of the woman coming up afterwards and saying, I think you're brilliant. And he's like, but that's not really helpful. Can you express what you're feeling and needing that, you know, led you to say that? And it took a while, actually. You know, she had variations of trying to say how he's brilliant. And it went to the situation where she looked into her notes and found out where she wrote down the things that were valuable to her that she's going to be able to use with her son, so they can connect better.
Mm-hmm.
That was the need that was being fulfilled in this process, by which she felt really happy that she encountered his ideas and so forth. So that's valuable to Marshall, obviously, much more valuable than someone just telling us what they think of us.
Yeah, and it is so hard, as I think Mike is alluding to it, it's so hard when everyone around you is speaking in this language, basically.
Or, and
that's
so am I, because I'm not used to it.
And, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's almost just second nature for us.
I mean, I just, as a total side note, I want to use profanity less in my life, and I've done it for so long, it's an incredibly difficult habit to break, and
mm-hmm.
this is probably going to be very similarly difficult for me
yeah.
to try and use better language.
Yeah, but as you learn NBC, it will become less and less important to use profanity.
It is. It really is learning almost a different language, and one that we've not grown up with. So it's a second language. I consider for me, speaking NBC is a
SL,
second language.
Yeah. NBC SL.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So yeah, one of the processes by which we dissolve these enemy images is to look at the other person and the judgments that they're forwarding against us as tragic expressions of unmet needs.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Because if they really knew the language of life, they would be able to articulate it in a way that wouldn't, you know, be susceptible to resistance on our part, because no one likes to be criticized, and really, ultimately, no one likes to be judged. And this flies in the face of Ayn Rand's dictum of judge and be prepared to be judged. You know, she said this in contrast to the Christian notion of judge not lest ye be judged, right? And a lot of people, including Rand, thought that, you know, left people off the hook. Like, they could get away with whatever they did that we didn't really like, that was not really life-giving to us or to them, for that matter. So she responded in the opposite direction of saying we need to judge people, and she was the ultimate moralizer. I mean, Nathaniel Brandon has noted that really no other person, except maybe some of the high priests of the Middle Ages, used the word evil with such frequency.
You know,
we got to the point of thinking certain things was evil, like not choosing to, like evasion, the defense mechanism of evasion, of not looking at the facts, not paying attention to truths, that was an act of evil to Ayn Rand. So right. You can imagine how many people this got out of her life as a result.
I mean,
lots of excommunications, lots of really bad episodes and hurt feelings and so on and so forth. So obviously she could have really utilized nonviolent communication.
Mm. And I think that goes back to what you said earlier about this kind of being the opposite of, almost like juxtaposed with RTR in a way, because, you know, a lot of that is about kind of ostracizing people from your life who haven't accepted these principles of voluntarism or whatever, or you feel like you're not making progress with them. And sort of making those judgments. Well, this is not a person I would want to be around. And I guess by saying that, you're almost sort of saying that person is evil, right?
Pretty much, they're lacking in virtue. So again, this judgment of others, which just builds resistance and almost guarantees we don't get our needs met with that person.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the rejoinder is probably that, well, I don't want that person to meet my needs because they're not a good person. Like, they're not being virtuous.
Yeah.
So it's like self-fulfilling prophecy at that point, isn't it?
So, but is the idea then that everybody can get along?
You know, well, it's a fact, I think, indisputable, that if everyone spoke this language, everyone pretty much would get along, because it's all about connecting empathetically with the other person's feelings and needs. So not using strategies that are harmful to other people's, to them meeting their needs. You know, being more aware, because once you're connected with your own feelings and needs, you're better able to see other people. And incidentally, this does not need to be used by both parties. I mean, oftentimes, since we're kind of on the cutting edge, I've never heard anyone speak this language outside of watching Marshall and some of the people that are on YouTube and so forth, on a consistent basis. So it's hard to translate it into our daily life, obviously. And I asked the guys on Free Talk Live if they'd ever heard of it. No, they hadn't either.
Right.
So for some reason, Marshall Rosenberg has been off the radar screen for the most part. And I think, you know, part of it is because these ideas are so powerful that they do dissolve all of the authoritarian structures that we see in our society if people use this consistently. Because it's impossible for someone to attack the other person when that other person is connecting with their feelings and needs, when they're empathizing. Like, when someone is empathizing with you, like really concerned and trying to understand where you're coming from, you don't really feel defensive towards them. You don't feel like you want to attack them, do you?
Yeah. I think so. I think it becomes really difficult to attack someone when they're showing genuine empathy for you. Because empathy really is, I think empathy is like the recognition that another person is a human being just like you and has certain things in common with you as a human being and deserves respect, right?
Yeah, yeah, there's a whole foundation to this, which was kind of off my radar screen because when I first read Nathaniel Brandon's book, The Psychology of Self-Esteem, gosh, it was probably 17 years ago, I really liked the fact that he grounded it in biology, mm-hmm. looked at the nature of human consciousness from a biological perspective. Like, what are the faculties of this organism? Well, they have a rational consciousness. Like, they integrate concepts, they make choices, and therefore they have values and means by which to gain and keep those values, virtues. Mm-hmm. And I guess you could translate the values and virtues into essentially strategies. The virtues would be the strategies by which to meet the values, which would be the needs. So by offering a biological approach, it really makes you aware that, yes, we are all organisms trying to survive on this planet, and we have to meet these needs in a way that is life-giving if we're going to be happy, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, so should we finish up this quick article, like the little how-to? We've read the first two little blurbs that are... state the observation that's leading you to feel the need to say something. Number two is state the feeling that the observation is triggering in you, or guess what the other person is feeling and ask. And then there are two more steps to practicing nonviolent communication, the Cliff Notes guide. So the third one is state the need that is the cause of that feeling, or guess the need that caused the feeling in the other person and ask. When our needs are met, we have happy, positive feelings. When they're not met, we have negative feelings. By tuning into the feeling, you can often find the underlying need. Stating the need without morally judging it gives you both clarity about what is alive in you or the other person in that moment. For example, sorry, Wes, did you want to jump in?
Well, I was just thinking something about the feeling, mm-hmm. and I think this is a subtle difference, but it's actually really important about when he says guess the feelings and guess the needs, because a lot of people may be used to the sort of jackal dialect of saying, what are you feeling right now? Or how do you feel about that? Or what do you need? And as Rosenberg says in the workshop, when you ask those kind of questions, that's really putting yourself at a disadvantage because you're not really implying or connoting the fact that you're connected with this person in that true self way, because if you're offering a guess as to what they're feeling as opposed to just asking them, what are you feeling, which kind of means that you're clueless, right? You're not involved in the conversation. You're not paying attention to what that person is doing or saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
So by just doing that guessing process, it really enables you to connect with feelings and needs and to stay present in that moment as opposed to, you know, just kind of like taking that position of putting the ball in their court and then seeing what happens.
Yeah, I think I've fallen into that trap myself a number of times.
It's an easy one to fall into.
And thinking that it was like an effective way to communicate, you know, I've said many times stuff like, well, I feel this way. How do you feel about this? And, you know, that's not really...
It's almost counterintuitive if you don't already know NVC. And I don't. And when you were first explaining or when you were first talking just now, I'm thinking, what? It's a bad idea to ask someone how they're feeling? It's just counterintuitive. And then when you kept talking, I'm all, oh, well, that makes perfect sense. I just didn't think of it. I was not implementing that.
Yeah, the intention is always good, right? But road to hell was
sometimes
with what? So, yeah, he uses these jackal puppets, and he also has these jackal ears and giraffe ears that you put on the head. And depending on how you're interacting, like with the jackal, by asking a question, for example, like, how are you feeling about that? That would be putting the jackal ears on backwards. So they're faced inward. It's almost like a way to put oneself down in a sense, like not be active minded, not be interested in that other person in a way that's connected to them, but rather waiting for the whatever's going to come out of that person, you know? It's a subtle difference, but it's really important, and it's one of the things I noticed that is really brilliant about this method, that it notes these subtleties and then amplifies them and makes you really aware that this is part of the process of really connecting with feelings and needs and being connected to true self processes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you're guessing at a feeling of the other person, it's basically impossible to do that without making an attempt at connecting, you know, showing some empathy.
I mean, it would be pretty obvious from your guess. If your guess is in left field or is in out in the desert compared to what it's totally irrelevant to the conversation, then that's going to be obvious that you're not connecting. But if your guess is anywhere in the ballpark, at least they know you're trying to connect. Does that sound about right?
I think the active-minded process is more important than whether or not it's correct or even in the ballpark, because like that example that Rosenberg gave about when he was crying and he asked the guy if he was upset.
Was way off.
The guy was actually thinking about how his wife was upset at him and calling him a stone, and they were getting the process of divorce, right? So it was completely out in left field, but the guy really looked at Marshall and knew that he was trying to connect with his feelings and needs, you know, and offering the best guess that he could by what he was perceiving, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this article goes on talking about stating the need that's the cause of the feeling or guessing the need that caused the feeling in the other person. So it says, it gives a couple of examples. For example, I see you looking away while I'm talking and you've been speaking so quietly I can't hear you. That's an observation. I'm feeling uncomfortable, feeling, because I'm needing connection right now, and that's stating the need. Or, I saw that your name wasn't mentioned in the acknowledgments. Are you feeling resentful because you're not getting the appreciation you need? Needs have a special meaning in NVC. They are common to all people, and not tied with any particular circumstance or strategy for fulfilling them. So, wanting to go to a movie with someone is not a need, and a desire to spend time with a specific person is not a need. The need in that case might be companionship. You can meet your need for companionship in many ways, not just with that specific person, and not just by going to a movie.
See, now, to me, again, an NVC noob, that seems counterintuitive, because it seems to me like I might have a need to spend time with the woman I love. And this is kind of saying, no, your need is to have companionship, or they use that as an example, but not with that specific person.
Yeah, it seems somewhat generic or discounting your emotional connection to that person, right? Because that person is special, right?
Well, that's what it feels to me, but maybe...
Wes said the S word.
I know. I was very aware of that, too.
Maybe they're actually... Maybe, although this paragraph is after the example paragraph, maybe that's just another example. The fact that you... Maybe it's a contextual example where you might be wanting to go to the movies with a person and really just wanting to be with a person, whereas that's not always the case. I don't know.
Well, I think what he's trying to do is differentiate needs from strategies, and he does this in the workshop too, and he talks about this specific, not this example, but this scenario. Because if you are connected to your needs, then you can become really aware of other people's strategies to meet their needs and to get your needs met in the process. So being with that one person is a strategy by which to get this need for connection met.
Okay.
And it's a really important strategy because of this person's way of looking at things, you know, how they interact with you and the way they're connected with themselves and all those kinds of things.
And it might be meeting your need for, it might be meeting several needs at once, right? Your need for connection,
yes.
Your need for love, your need for visibility. You know.
A multiplicity of them, yeah. And humans have a real penchant for categories and categorization. So we can slice and dice the needs up in as many ways and even cobble them together because obviously I think self-esteem is a huge need. It's one of our main values to be able to have this conviction that our mind is competent to think and judge the facts of reality and the feeling that a person is worthy of happiness. That's Nathaniel Brandon's definition, and yet it's not listed in the needs here, but I think if you cobble together some of these, you end up with that. So it's just, it's a flexible process, and it's more about this sort of guessing game to try to connect with what's actually really going on a foundational level, right?
Mm-hmm. So Mike, do you want to finish up the last one?
The last step after observations, feelings, and needs is requests, and actually it's more like solutions. So 4, make a concrete request for action to meet the need just identified. Ask clearly and specifically for what you want right now, rather than hinting or stating only what you don't want. For example, I noticed that you haven't spoken in the last 10 minutes, which is an observation. Are you feeling bored? Which is a guess at a feeling. If the answer is yes, you might bring up your own feeling and propose an action. Well, I'm bored too. Hey, how'd you like to go to the Exploratorium? Which is a very San Francisco-specific reference. Or, and the article continues, or perhaps, I'm finding these people really interesting to talk with. How about we meet up in an hour when I'm done here? For the request to be really a request and not a demand, allow the other person to say no or propose an alternative. You take responsibility for getting your own needs met, and you let them take responsibility for theirs. Their last little paragraph here is, when you do something together, you want it to be because you both voluntarily consent to it, as a way of fulfilling your own genuine needs and desires, not out of guilt or pressure. Sometimes you can find an action that meets both your needs, and sometimes you just have to amiably go your separate ways. If you're not ready to ask in this spirit, that's okay. You probably just need some more empathy yourself. little cute ending there.
Yeah. Self-empathy is really important in this process, too. Yeah, I think that this dovetails perfectly with the Liberty message, you know, because it's all about volitional, self-motivated, intrinsically motivated action. You know, doing it because we want to do it. Right, rather than being coerced or manipulated or guilt-tripped or anything like that.
This is like what we're all about. You know, it's about persuasion. It's about voluntary interactions.
Yeah, I'm very pleased that they used the word voluntary in that last description.
Yeah.
Hey, Wes, you said just a second ago self-empathy. How would you define self-empathy?
Well, from an NVC point of view, it's connecting with the feelings and needs within ourselves. So if we're feeling angry, for example, he mentions this in one of the chapters of his book, that's kind of a wake-up call, because anger is not this true self-emotion. It's sort of a tragic, and when it comes out in action, it's a tragic way of saying, please meet this need I have of something, right? But this is the really poor strategy we have. And when we're not connected with our actual need, it can snowball out of control, right? So
would you say that self-empathy is kind of like looking at your emotions from a step back?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's basically turning that searchlight into yourself, right, as opposed to the other person's feelings and needs. So doing the same process with yourself, like, what's going on? What am I feeling? And what need am I trying to get met?
Okay.
And what need is not being met? What strategies am I using to meet my needs? And how is that failing? Mm-hmm. Right? So it's just really trying to connect on a foundational level as a biological organism. How are you acting in the world? And what sort of things are going on the emotional level, like the blaming, actually the shaming. Shaming and guilt are two emotions that Rosenberg identifies as self-attack, basically. That's what the jackal ears turned inward once again, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's obviously, you know, obtained from our developmental psychology when we interacted with people that never really were connected to their feelings and needs and never really worked on their self-esteem, and they end up attacking us and diminishing the value within us, or getting us to do that, actually.
Yeah.
There's this process of taking responsibility for all this, all the emotional stuff. And in the audiobook, he has a really good discussion about taking responsibility for our feelings, basically saying that other people are responsible for their feelings, we're responsible for ours, and it shouldn't get into that sort of evaluation thing where this person disrespected me, right? Because that's not being responsible for what we're feeling. Because in point of fact, whatever people do is beyond our control, right? Mm-hmm. All we are is in control of our own feelings and our own needs. So the more we focus on that in a self-responsible way, the clearer we can see what's actually going on. And we won't take the things that the other person is doing or saying very personally, as personally as we would otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a section in this little workbook I have that's like a compilation of his main book and another workbook and another book that he has. It's only like 84 pages, but I can give it to you guys if you want to put a link to it somewhere. It's pretty,
that would be
it's pretty
great.
Comprehensive because it's all the high points too.
Yeah, sounds good.
But the section here says 4 options on how to receive a negative message. When someone gives us a negative message, whatever, verbally or non-verbally, we have 4 options as to how to receive it. Such as, you are the most self-centered person I've ever met. Okay, 1, choose to take it personally and accept the other person's judgment and blame ourselves, guilt, shame, depression, which would be, oh, I should have been more sensitive, right? I'm sorry. And by the way, NBC doesn't promote the idea of saying sorry or apologizing because it's not really connecting with feelings and needs in a way that's going to enable us to use better strategies to change for the benefit of the other person to get their needs met as well as ourselves. So that's an interesting thing in and of itself we can discuss later, but...
Slightly counterintuitive, yet again.
Yeah, exactly. The nature of counterintuitive NVC. So two, the other way, the option to respond to a negative message, blame the speaker and feel anger. You have no right to say that. I'm always considering your needs. You're the one who's really self-centered. Okay, that's a real common one, right?
That doesn't seem too productive, no. Just on its face, even
and
for someone
probably, it sounds very defensive and not necessarily even true, just something to blurt out.
Yeah.
But how often does that happen
in
relationships
all the time.
And families?
Yeah.
You know, these first two options are typically the go-to ones.
Yeah.
Right.
The next two are the NVC type. So, three, shine the light of consciousness on your own feelings and needs. When I hear you saying that I am the most self-centered person you've ever met, I feel hurt. Because I need some recognition on my efforts to be considerate of your preferences. Now, that sounds a bit stilted and a little bit wordy, but Rosenberg notes that this process does take some time. It does take a while to try to adjust one's focus to look at the feelings and needs rather than our natural inclinations, right?
Well, I completely agree. From this little Wikipedia Cliff's Notes super summary, it sounds... You know, it's in very clear language, and I understand it, but it sounds like one of the most difficult things that I'll ever have to do is to try and convert to this language.
But yet, Mike, it'll also be the most beneficial thing
probably
one can ever do. Essentially, like, I've come to that conclusion, and I've tried to poke holes in this because it is a challenge to really reframe oneself, but every step that we take to do that, we benefit in terms of being able to connect with our feelings and needs and get our needs met by the people in our lives.
And Wes, as you said before, I mean, it's so... The beauty of this is that only one person needs to be using it.
Well, I have a question about
Absolutely. It can neutralize. Like, when you're in giraffe mode, you can neutralize any jackal out there. And he gives examples that are the most extreme imaginable. For example, this woman says... She was working in a clinic for drug addiction, I think. This man comes in, and he says, I want a room. And she says, I'm sorry, we're all booked up. He throws her to the floor and puts a knife to her throat.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Buttons her. Okay.
That's
So I think this is the one she remembered Marshall saying, never say but. Never put your butt in the face of someone angry. You know, I'd like to help you, but... Right?
Yeah.
So she knew that, and then she switched into NVC mode, and within a few minutes, they were talking together and collaborating on how to find this man a room somewhere else.
Wow. A few minutes after he had, threatened her with a knife. Wow.
Yes. Wow. It might have been 20 minutes or half an hour. I don't know how long the altercation lasted, but in any event, the NVC neutralized a person that was on the verge of killing her, essentially. And there's another instance where a woman relates... almost being raped, and by using NVC, all they did was take her purse.
Sounds like voting.
Wow, that was excellent. So, would you think then that roughly half of any community really only is all that's needed to practice NVC for a very harmonious community?
I think so. In the long run, you're going to have people understanding it on a deep level, obviously. So every time we interface with someone who's not versed in this language, it is an educational experience for both parties, right? And I think that's the first time in that other person's life that someone is really genuinely concerned with their feelings and needs, that really empathized with them to the point where they couldn't, they don't feel defensive or resisting anymore. So, imagine the possibilities in the activism world because of this.
Oh, yeah, they're incredible, and I would love it if we could use that as a segue to talk about them.
Before we get to that, the fourth option to how to receive a negative message was shine the light of consciousness on the other person's feelings and needs as they are currently expressed. Are you feeling hurt because you need more consideration for your preferences?
The NVC would say that you should actually ask that, not just think about it and act, right?
So someone
who's thrown you on the ground and has a knife pointed at you or whatever, in your chest or whatever, You should be asking them, are you hurt because of blah, 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 not just thinking it and trying to act.
Well, I guess in that overt situation, you could identify, you wouldn't have to ask, are you feeling hurt? Right. I can see you're extremely mad, right? And connect with those feelings and needs. And also in that process, it's important for that victimizer to empathize with the victim. So the potential victim should say, I'm feeling really scared. I'm feeling, you know, my need for safety is being jeopardized, you know, to get that personalization process happening too.
That's interesting, because that again sounds either counterintuitive or possibly dangerous, because someone who's not into nonviolence, i.e. the person with the knife, they might have some issues going on where they like the control. They like someone being weak. It is their goal to have them express weakness, you know, being pee their pants or say, I'm feeling scared. And that mightn't that egg them on?
Well, that's where you've got to refocus back into their feelings and needs.
Wow.
Right? So if you're still seeing resistance, if you're still seeing that violence coming out potentially, then it's a matter of focusing on that, because as Marshall Rosenberg says, the other person is not going to be able to see our needs and connect with our feelings until they feel empathized with. And that's a tough one. Like I said, the enemy imagery just pops up naturally when someone is threatening violence against you, obviously.
Yeah, boy, I don't know even if I'm able to use NVC in certain circumstances. I mean, right now, looking at myself, I don't know if I would be able to do it in that circumstance. And yet, if I studied this royal and practiced it, maybe it would be second nature when it actually happens. Who knows?
Yeah, all the liberty activists that are advocates of the Second Amendment would find another solution, perhaps, in that situation.
That's possible.
That might be my inclination, too. But if you can defuse it and get that person to connect with who they really are, like dissolve their all their defenses and get them connected to true self, and they turn into the real person again, isn't that a better route than dispatching them with a .44 Magnum?
Well, absolutely, and I wasn't even suggesting violence back, but whatever the tactic, if it wasn't NVC, it wouldn't, I guess, be as efficient. But if someone's pointing a gun or a knife at me, I don't know if I'd be courageous enough to try to state what I'm observing and ask them tell them what my feelings are and do this process in the fear that it just might not work and he'd shove the knife into me.
Yeah. Well, the other strategy, the way to use the dialects of Jackal that we know, definitely doesn't work.
Well, I guess so.
So this is getting both of our needs met, a win-win scenario. And he's worked in the most extreme conditions, like I said, he's worked in prisons with murderers and rapists, like bringing a rape victim to a prison and having that process happen.
Yeah.
That rape victim ends up really, really connecting with that other person's feelings and needs and showing true remorse in the process.
You mean the rapist shows true remorse or the victim? I didn't understand what you were saying.
Yeah, the rapist shows true remorse, which is what the victim intends. Obviously, the victim comes in with all the enemy imagery, right?
Right, yeah.
And then the rapist is aloof and, you know, just dismissive and maybe on the surface says they're sorry or something like that, but there's not that connection with the feelings and needs and how their strategies to meet that need, for example, for sexual expression or for power or control or some sense of efficacy, was not met, and they use this horrible strategy, right? But when they connect with those feelings and needs, you get this amazing process that happens. And one of the examples that he gives too, I think this is an audiobook, where this man in the prison was really mad because the request that he made of the guards, some bureaucratic process by which he was going to get, I think, anger management training or something like that. And Marshall was working with him with NVC and got him to connect with what he's actually feeling beneath the anger towards those other people. And it was fear that if he didn't get this training, he said, if I didn't get this training, Marshall, I fear that I'm going to be back in here right after I get out of here. And then Marshall talked to him some more with NVC, and pretty soon the guy's head was just looking down and he's really despondent. And Marshall asked him what he's feeling. And he said,
oh, he should have guessed.
Well, yeah, I'm getting the story wrong.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, he inquired, as to what's going on with this guy. And he said, well, Marshall, if I would have known this language 2 years ago, I wouldn't have had to kill my best friend.
Oh, boy. Wow.
So even the language had to kill.
I was just thinking that.
There's nothing that we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
He gives another example of a guy in a Palestinian refugee camp, I think it was, where an Israeli guard says, take your clothes off or I'm going to kill you. I'm going to shoot you. You know, he's holding them at gunpoint,
mm-hmm,
at one of these checkpoints or something, just for humiliation, right?
Yeah.
And he said, Marshall, this is an example of having no choice. And I think a lot of people in the Liberty Movement would say similarly, that we have no choice to pay our taxes.
Well,
we're forced. We're coerced. We have to.
At least this one I understand.
Yeah.
It is truly a choice, even if it's one.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So we asked the guy, so what did you choose?
Yeah.
Well, I chose to keep my dignity, and I kept my clothes on. And Marshall says, well, you're here, so either the guy's a really bad shot or he didn't pull the trigger, right? And he said, yeah. So I think how different would the world be if we took real responsibility for our choices, even in the midst of this coercive stuff that we see with statism?
Mm.
You know, yeah. Most people, like I've talked on my podcast, they send their tax money in without even a peep of protest or questioning or anything. You know, they do it almost automatically, and then they grumble, mm-hmm, about the fact that they're forced to be tax slaves.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of people, you know, I've heard people talk about that before, and a lot of them just say, "Well, I'm just so scared," you know.
But I guess what's happening. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Mike. That's fine.
Well, I guess what's happening from an NVC point of view is that they're not analyzing their feeling of being scared in the moment. They're just doing it, and then much later saying, I'm scared. Does that sound about right?
I don't know. I guess probably everyone's an individual. What do you think, Wes? Can you analyze this situation? Because it's really common, right, to hear people say that.
Realizing that analyzing would be a form of
jackal.
Non-violent communication.
Well, can you empathize with the people who feel afraid to even...
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, but it's like the steps, right? Because when a person's looking at a piece of paper with a thread on it, that's not overt violence. That's a threat, right? And they're expecting, they're using words to get you to comply.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I did an episode way back when, I think it was in the 60s, talking about slave speak and how we use, how...
Oh, not the 1960s. The 60, episode 60s. Episode 60 of Complete Liberty.
Yeah, they're like, back in my day, we did an episode.
We didn't have podcasts.
So, yeah, when people use words, most often... they're not using overt violence. They're just using words to get us to comply. You know, even police officers, so-called,
mm-hmm,
use words predominantly to get us to comply. And so using words in the form of nonviolent communication to get our needs met, right,
mm-hmm,
as well as somehow figure out how they can use a different strategy to get their needs met, I think that's the way to true freedom here.
It's very, yeah, this is very interesting, Wes. I don't feel like I understand fully all the implications of this for liberty, and I do enjoy talking about this with you. But one thing I wanted to ask or talk about was, you know, there are a couple different situations, like, for instance, getting a letter from the IRS or a nasty letter threatening you for not filing income tax return, and getting pulled over by a police officer when you're driving, or encountering a police officer on the street who stops and demands your identification. Those are two different scenarios, because in one, you're actually face-to-face with a person, whereas in the other, it's sort of like this faceless entity that you're dealing with. And how would you apply the principles of nonviolent communication in this situation where there's not really a person in front of you?
Well, unfortunately, Marshall doesn't guide us in the direction here for clarity, because I've never seen or read anything yet about dealing in that way. It's always been face-to-face.
Mm-hmm. Well, like what about by email?
In Africa, they took 6 months to get them together to actually do a mediation.
Well, you can't empathize with a collective, so how would it work?
No, you have to find out who that person is. Like my friend Mike, he comes on the show on occasion, Complete Liberty Podcast, and he calls up the bureaucrats directly.
Yeah.
And essentially his words are, he makes them pay a spiritual price for what they're doing. Hmm. Now, I've recently introduced him to nonviolent communication, so he's reorienting his perspective on this too.
Right.
Because though it may feel good to make them pay a spiritual price, I mean, he's had them cry, he's had them scream and yell and all kinds of things by just holding up a mirror saying, you're a violent person, you're being violent, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is not a voluntary interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, other than the threat of physical violence, what's the nature of our relationship?
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, can't answer, right? So they come up with all the collectivistic speak, and you're part of the community, and you owe a debt to society.
Signed
and
a social contract.
Yeah, all that nonsense. So those are all just rationalizations that the jackal language employs to try to justify what they're doing. So as a consequence of NBC, it would be a different interaction where you're actually connecting with that person, because when you're challenging them, obviously they're feeling fear, they're feeling anger, they're feeling upset, all those kinds of things. So if you delve into their feelings and needs, and people were to do this on a daily basis with people, I think that things would change dramatically. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of getting people versed in the language and being fluent in it so that they can call some bureaucrat and talk to them in a way that is empathetic, you know?
I agree, except that it feels to me more than just getting versed in the language. It feels to me like understanding the language and making the complete mindset, the worldview change necessary to accommodate it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. Yes. It's not like if I say the same things I'm saying now in French, then we'll all get along. It's not a different language only.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that makes it a lot harder. I have to. You know, here's what, I guess what I'm trying to say.
Harder for the communication process, or harder for oneself to adopt it?
Oneself to adopt it. And I think I should reword what I'm trying to say to this. Did I just lose my train of thought?
Get it back on the rails.
Get the heck on the Well, go ahead and comment on that, and if I can reword it, I will.
Maybe I lost my train too.
I derailed us all.
I think I'm on the caboose, Mike. I don't know where this train's going.
Well, we think about that. I just am kind of wondering, Wes, and maybe we can kind of use this to get into a little bit about applying this to some situations, some example situations in our own lives. But there was a situation recently where I was trying to use to practice nonviolent communication in an email thread with somebody. And I don't know how successful it was. I mean, obviously I'm a little bit of a newbie at nonviolent communication, but I was trying, you know, I was trying to ask questions and say, you know, are you feeling this way because of this, this fact, this observation, and ask the person, and try to connect with them. And, you know, I don't know how well it worked. I think face-to-face would probably be better for something like this, but like, how can we use this in the written realm?
Well, it's difficult because you can't, you know, you're not in a human interface so much, just pixels on a screen, right? So
yeah, that's sort of...
You just have to do the best guessing process of what they're feeling and needing. Actually, I have an example of this. My friend recently had a potential customer that got really angry because something was not done when it was said it was going to be done, like receiving an email at a certain time for a certain offer or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he responded with a lot of anger and a demand for an apology and a whole bunch of stuff. And the first person in their business that responded used the language of jackal to basically say, you know, it's not our responsibility. I can understand what you're upset, but it's not a responsibility, and, you know, basically trying to justify it instead of connecting with the guy's feelings and needs. So then it was a process of doing damage control. After that happened, then the guy responded back with even more accusations and judgment and even threats of using the law against these guys for fraud or something.
Oh, boy.
Right? So what to do now? So my friend and I just kind of racked our brains, and we composed a way to deal with this, respond in an NBC fashion. And he sent the email to the guy, and just as he suspected, it worked. Because the guy responded in an understanding way now. Now, he slipped into, when he had the enemy, we started talking about the enemy images he had of the first person in their business that responded to him. He basically said, well, your message to me was so not like this other guy that you're working with. I don't know what's up with that guy. Maybe he's having a bad day or something. And then he would go off on his accusations and judgments about all that.
Right.
But in terms of connecting with my friend, he totally did. And he totally didn't counterattack.
Mm-hmm.
So I think even in that instance, when you don't even know, a complete stranger, basically, that's really mad and even threatening to use the guns of government to get their way, if you do empathize and connect with their feelings and needs, it's really, really hard for them to be judgmental towards you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I had an experience today, and I've been reviewing it in my mind as this conversation's been progressing. And there was no NVC involved. In fact,
I called it violent non-communication
instead,
which is the opposite of non-violent.
And I'd like to say that it was basically not my fault, but now I'm not so sure because of my reactions. So, and there's a, I guess I don't want to. Okay, so a person who I've never met, but who we know of each other, took some of my property off of my property, off of my, you know, site where I'm building a house. Without
notifying you.
Right.
Without requesting.
Correct. When I wasn't there and without asking me or notifying me. And I found out and I sent him a private message saying, essentially, you might have thought this belonged to, you know, your friend Bob, but it's actually mine and I'd like you to return it. And he didn't respond a day later, so I went to where he was at so I could talk to him in person. And I got as far as saying, hi, and I was going to introduce myself and say, you know, are you this person? I know his name. Are you this person? And I'm Mike. I'm the guy who owns that property. And I was going to proceed. But I got as far as saying hi, and he started shouting, I've got nothing to say to you. Get out of my job site, and yelling and threatening me. And then it progressed from there to him pushing me, physically pushing me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to say I really did nothing wrong, and I but you know, I did. Judging from the little bit of NVC I know so far, when he started flying off the handle, what I did was not NVC. I started asking him questions. Why aren't you responding? Why aren't you giving me back my property?
Why are you hurting me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was remaining calm and friendly. And in fact, I was really proud of how I handled it compared to, you know, where I've been in the past in my life. But now I wonder, even though I was on the defensive instantly, hi, and then I get threats, that obviously I could have empathized more and perhaps, you know, I'm not as convinced as you are that it will always work, but perhaps I could have dissuaded him from harming me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was skeptical that it might not work in many instances or in some instances, but from what I've seen and from my understanding of human psychology, it seems to work each and every time. Well, it may not work totally, or it's not to say that there's not going to be relapses at times, but in the moment when you're doing it, again, it's really an amazing thing to see that other person actually reorient themselves so that they're actually listening to you as a consequence of you listening to them. Obviously, only one person needs to know this, so once they start communicating in it, it's incumbent upon them to really empathize with that other person, connect with their feelings and needs, so that now they can get their needs met. There's a nice quote here in this one chapter. He says, "The purpose of nonviolent communication is to create a connection that allows compassionate giving to take place. When we look at how nonviolent communication can contribute to change, remember this. We want people to change because they see better ways of meeting their needs at less cost, not because of fear that we're going to punish them or, quote, guilt, or guilt them if they don't. First, we'll look at how the change can occur within ourselves, and then with the other people whose behavior is not in harmony with our values, and then with social structures that are operating in ways that are not in harmony with our values." So in this instance, obviously, your needs were not met, especially your need for safety.
But I don't think I expressed it.
No. And, you know, it's interesting because I got in a sort of an argument with a guy at a meetup somewhere. There was a talk, I guess it was, at some meetup group that wasn't libertarian oriented. They were kind of social democratic.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a guy there that was doing the audio video stuff, and I thought he was a liberty lover and so forth, but he took issue with some of the things that I was saying. So in the midst of our sort of discussion, which kind of went into an argument, I just said what he's feeling, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't guess. I just said, it seems you're really angry. And when I said that, he even got angrier, right? He threatened to use violence against me, and which I was fully prepared for, but it never happened, and he just kind of stormed off. So there was something that wasn't quite right in my process of doing this. And obviously, if you were to say that to that guy in that way, it probably wouldn't have been helpful. But to try to identify what he's feeling, I can see that you're really upset. I can see that, you know, your need for whatever is not being met. I mean, I don't know what he suspected you were doing. Do you have an idea of what was generating the feelings based on whatever needs were not being met in him?
No, like I said, I've never met the guy before, but actually, apparently, it's irrelevant, because if I had just guessed, you're saying that the process of trying to empathize would have been enough to start the
process? Yes.
So I could have said, let's see, so I walk up and say hi, and he starts yelling, get off my job site, I have nothing to say to you. I could have said, you seem really angry. Let me go back to my notes in this article here. I could have said something like, I see that you're yelling at me when I've not even introduced myself.
Actually, when you say yelling, it reminds me of the workshop where someone said that. Like, this one boy said that his brother yells at him because he's going to be late for school.
Uh-huh.
And Rosenberg said, no, actually, yelling is not MVC because it's a judgment.
Yelling is a judgment? How you said shouting earlier. Shouting's not a judgment?
Shouting. Shouting would be a judgment too. That'd be my bad if I said that.
Wow.
It's basically raising your voice.
Okay, so.
Because yelling connotes something they're doing to you, in a sense. You're yelling at me. You're accusing me of something, kind of thing, you know? Shouting. There's an evaluation inherent in that, as opposed to saying, I see that you're raising your voice. Are you mad because your need for, privacy is not being met? Something like that.
Yeah, I could have said something and guessed. But now I'm kind of leaving off my example and just being mind blown again by not the semantics, but I mean, it seems to me that raising your voice can connote something to some people. So, I mean, every word can connote or denote something. I guess some are obviously worse than others.
Yeah, so the point is, how do we use language in a way that doesn't generate resistance and counterattack in the other person? That's the goal, right?
So I would have just had to assess who I'm dealing with and what's happening and try and use the language that I think is the most, or the least insinuative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Lots of practice I'm going to need.
Well, I think I'm going to need a lot of practice, too.
This would be a not only would this be exceptionally useful to liberty activists,
mm-hmm.
I said this backwards, to anyone in all of their relationships, but it would be especially helpful to liberty activists who are also trying to get people to be more free.
Yeah.
And I think this would just be a fantastic seminar, kind of like Pimp My Activism, to be practicing up here with the people around us.
Yeah, absolutely. If we can, inspire as many people as possible to learn this language and to utilize it, we're going to accelerate this process big time.
Wow.
And get our needs met.
This is the cool thing. Like, we both get our needs met. It's not about, there's not this, like Rosenberg says, the giraffe is not nice in the sense that it's a pushover. It's willing to sacrifice his needs for somebody else's because there's this assertiveness aspect to say, my needs aren't getting met. But in order for that to happen, I need to figure out what's going on in you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that you're connected with your feelings and needs, and then therefore your strategies to meet those things don't come at the expense of mine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people, again, aren't used to this. They're not used to being connected with themselves in this sort of true self, genuine way.
Yeah. I find it, at times I almost feel overwhelmed But then I realized that this is so worthwhile trying to practice and learn. And it's okay if I try to do this, make an attempt, and don't do it perfectly. You know, at least I'm getting in the right direction, right?
It's really sounding revolutionary to me.
It certainly is.
Wow, it's just
and evolutionary.
Yeah, peaceful evolution.
It's revolutionary in the sense that, you know, he notes that primitive tribes, many of them used nonviolent communication methods. Which is interesting, because I would think that, again, the interesting thing about this is that it is a communication method. It is a language. It's a way we can use words to get our needs met and to understand ourselves and understand other people in a real authentic way. But at the same time, it's happening in a context, and there's a logical, philosophical framework that I think needs to be incorporated into this so that we understand, you know, the priorities of our needs and so forth. Because a lot of people, obviously, they have the need for autonomy, but it's not being met in any form or fashion by the system of government that exists. Any system of government is inimical to getting our need for autonomy and choice and independence met. So,
and the family structure as well.
Yeah. And Rosenberg has worked with a lot of institutions, right? He's worked in corporations with people with disputes, and he's worked even between governments and officials and so forth. So, but he's very aware, and he's worked with principals of public schools even. And I guess in those isolated moments when he's using this with these people, they do become true self, but again, they're lost in the context of the domination culture and these institutions that are set up to facilitate some people dominating other people, right? So I think that we can't just throw philosophy out. We have to incorporate a logical way of looking at philosophy to get our needs met in a way that is win-win and leads to prosperity economically, too.
Mm-hmm. Very well said, Wes.
Well, I've been studying this for the last few weeks, and I tell you, it's been a challenge. Mm-hmm. But as I study it more and more, it becomes so clear to me that if I had used this language in years previous, things would have been different, right? Mm-hmm. I could have gotten many more needs met. So it's that important, and it's something that's really inspiring. I'm glad that I did come across it now as opposed to later. Obviously, there's no better time than the present. So
this is true, and we can only control what happens in our lives from this point forward. So glad to know about it now.
Yeah, I'm very glad to have heard about this, and I'm going to be mulling this over for quite a while, and it's mind-blowing to me.
It really is, and it has huge implications any way you look at it. And it's really about finding what's alive in yourself, what's alive in other people. He really stresses that, and I really like that aspect, too. It gets back to the biology stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. And
what's alive in us? What's real rather than phony? What are the masks that we're wearing to pretend that we are getting our needs met or to act as if we're not sacrificing and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. I think we've talked about this enough for our listeners to at least get a good taste, a sample of what NVC is all about. And if they want to find out more, where can they go for resources? We mentioned the Nonviolent Communication book and audiobook, but there's also the Center for Nonviolent Communication, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that website. And it has a really cool thing to either print out or just refer to whenever you're on your computer. It's the Needs Inventory and the Feelings Inventory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at cnvc.org, Center for Nonviolent Communication.org.
Yes, that's right. So if you like the sort of interactive approach with the websites, there's articles on there, there's the Needs and Feelings Inventory. I know Marshall Rosenberg has written a lot of other short articles too, in addition to the book and addition to these seminars that he televises and puts on YouTube. So definitely recommend checking those out in whatever form of information is most appealing to you. And Wes, I'm so glad we got to have a discussion about this with you.
I really enjoyed this conversation.
I did too. It was really fulfilling to me. It met my need for understanding this new language.
It was
and
very.
I was happy to converse with you guys about it.
Maybe we could have another conversation when we're all a little more advanced on the topic.
Yeah, to be continued, because there are so many facets to this. I think that the sky's the limit.
Yeah, I would definitely like to revisit this. I think it would be really useful to sort of collect our experiences with using this in life and liberty activism and discuss it again. And I also want to say that I was trying to think of how to phrase this.
What did you say now? Come on.
I wouldn't say thank you for joining us because that's not in line with NBC. So I'm going to say.
Oh, yes, it is. Thank you is definitely in line with NBC.
Thank you.
Thank you, but not sorry and not please.
No.
Okay, so there's tragic ways of saying please and thank you. And the tragic ways of saying please are all the accusations, the judgments, the diagnoses, and all that stuff. Tragic ways of saying thank you are, you know, all the judgments of good and the rewards that we give people, the compliments, all those kinds of things.
Oh, I was thinking of this, of good job.
That would be a tragic way of saying thank you.
How about you've spent an hour and a half talking with us, and I feel that was a lot of your time, and a lot of my time, and
I feel very appreciative. It was time well spent.
Yeah, you're right. I did feel totally wrong.
I consider it time well spent.
Absolutely, it went by really quickly. And when you start talking about this stuff, it really, really is mind blowing. And I would recommend people do check out the YouTube videos, because seeing is believing. If you're skeptical about this, and even if you read the book, I've known people that have read the book and yet have a really hard time translating it into their everyday lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they understand that they're reading these pages and they're saying, yeah, they're nodding their head and that sounds really reasonable, that sounds really important and so forth. But then they close the book and they go about doing and saying the same things that they've done, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you watch the workshop especially, and when you watch all the other videos on YouTube, you know, they give those suggested videos. Just immerse yourself in that and watch the way he uses the puppets, too. I mean, it just really sinks in that way.
Yes, I have to agree with you. The very first time I saw the puppets in action, my first thought was, oh my gosh, this is so, like, hippie granola.
We're back to Sesame Street.
Yeah, I think I definitely made a judgment there. And I ended up having a different view of them when I was finished watching and thinking that the puppets were very useful to illustrate what was actually going on in the dialogue, you know, that they represented. So I agree with you, Wes. I think the videos are worth checking out. And
it's funny. He has in the workshop, he talks about, okay, we have this amazing technology by which we can hear past all the people's attacks and insults and judgments and see their feelings and needs and their message.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulls out this little thing and he puts it on his head. It's the giraffe ears.
Yep.
Yeah. Amazing technology.
It's all the technology you need, I guess, to practice this.
Well, thank you for not only spending the time with us, but for enlightening me.
Absolutely. Well, you're welcome. I really enjoyed it. And I hope to do it again sometime. You guys are doing great work. And I think
you are too.
You know, talking about relationships from a liberty perspective is good for everybody. Now, that might be a non-NBC judgment. Let me think about
that. It's good for everybody.
We do have
if
a cute
if you see the
on.
Value in it and want it willingly and are intrinsically motivated to accept it and invite it in your life, then by all means, right?
And Wes, similarly, I've always enjoyed listening to your podcast, and I think that the things that you've been talking about, especially of late with all the personal freedom stuff and delving into the family and rewards and punishments and even getting at the political structure with your series on voting has been very informative and useful, and I appreciate what you're doing, too.
Can you please tell our listeners where they can hear your work?
Yes, just go to CompleteLiberty.com, and you can find a link to the podcast there with all the show notes. I usually create copious show notes with lots of links and stuff, so
they're
if you're
famous.
Into all a bunch of information, check that out. And my other site I do with Kevin, my business partner and friend, healthymindfitbody.com.
Yeah.
Looking into lifestyle changes, health and fitness, and so forth. We do a weekly podcast there too.
And that really, I definitely wanted to, I'm glad you touched on Healthy Mind, Fit Body too, Wes, because it really goes in line with the personal freedom aspect of things, you know, kind of freeing yourself from disease, obesity, you know, helping with self-confidence, all that kind of stuff. A lot of issues. You touch on the psychological aspects of self-image, body image, weight loss. So definitely recommend folks check that out.
Yeah, I really value the sentence completion process that Nathaniel Brandon has kind of perfected with his workbooks and so forth, because they really allow you to delve into subconscious thoughts and feelings. And I think that's a real necessary process. And in relation to NBC, I think it's important to see NBC as a way to open the mind to delving into that stuff, because there is a lot of resistance to going deep into, you know, our psyche to explore those experiences that we had early on in life, relationship to mother and father, the judgments we passed on ourselves, the judgments others passed on ourselves. Mm-hmm. That can be kind of a scary thing. And I think that NBC allows us to really connect with that empathetic part of ourselves and to delve into that, to want to delve into that, to see it as something really good and positive. And so I think it works well with that too. And I guess I should mention I have another site, happinesscounseling.com, which I do counseling services online for people to work through issues and so forth. So
yes, absolutely. And I give Wes my personal recommendation as a very empathetic and wonderful person to talk to.
And nonviolent.
Thank you. Yes, I won't use any violence, language or action. Well, at least I'll try in the language department, because this is a work in progress for everybody, obviously.
Absolutely.
The compliments thing is a tough one. You know, we're so used to doing that in a way that's, you know, supposedly violent, right? It's not actually overtly violent, but it is taking the position of being a judge. And obviously, our self-worth should not be open for debate. And I think parents get in this sort of process of telling kids how they're doing good and doing bad. And that gets reflected in that little kid's self-assessment, right? Mm-hmm. So when I'm doing good things, I'm good. I'm a good person. When I'm doing bad things, I'm a bad person.
Yeah, they really internalize that. And I've even heard parents or even psychologists say things like, well, kids, until they reach a certain age, don't even understand anything except rewards and punishments. So you have to speak in those terms towards them.
Self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it?
Yes.
There's a great book by Alfie Cohn, who's the researcher behind all this operant conditioning, the pop behaviorism he talks about, called Unconditional Parenting. Highly recommend that book. Yes. Now, Alfie, turns out, I corresponded with him through email, and he's not a fan of the Rand.
The Rand.
Actually, just the opposite. He's more or less socialistic in his thinking politically. So, you know, he's compartmentalized stuff, it seems. And, of course, I'm using nonviolent communication. I'm assessing. But in any event, he's able to shelve that aside and focus on these dynamics that are operating in families and in schools and so forth, to really, you know, enlighten people about this process of looking at intrinsic motivation rather than extrinsic rewards and punishments.
Absolutely. So, Wes, thank you again for joining us tonight. And
thank you.
I had fun.
I really enjoyed it.
And if you want to hear our past episodes or check out what... What's that?
And now I don't know why our listeners would want to listen to any of our episodes. I'll go over to Wes's sites. But if you do want to, it's you can go to our website, porktherapy.com.
Yep, that's porctherapy.com. And if you usually, you know, we broke format tonight. We usually do a relationship question that we've gotten from one of our listeners. But if you want to, but instead we were talking with Wes tonight. But if you want to send us your questions, you can email us at questions@porktherapy.com. Or you can call us at our phone number, 419-PT-LOVE-4, and leave us a voicemail in your lovely voice and sing us a song. You can even say, last time we put out the offer for someone to sing us our own theme song, and that we would play it as the intro to our next podcast. So nobody's taken us up on that yet, but I'm confident that someone will rise to the occasion.
Some brave soul. Yeah. Hit the high notes.
They would have to be brave. So...
thanks for listening, all you people in podcast land.
Yes, we certainly do appreciate your ears and hope you have a wonderful night. And thanks again, Wes.
Thank you, Wes.
Take care, everyone.
There
they're two crazy porks who host a show. They give relationship advice that you ought to know. Your thirst for entertainment, they will quench, cause Stephanie's a darling and Mike is a mensch. Pork therapy, advice this good is a rarity. It's cool, fun, and introspective. Relationship talk from a liberty perspective, oh. And did I mention you can leave a message, you can voice a question, a joke, a comment, or something more. At